I'm very honored to be asked to give this lecture, can I call it a talk, to give this lecture. I really am honored. Thank you to CMF for the opportunity to talk about issues primarily of leadership. That's what I want to talk about today, so a big thank you for that. And thank you to Pablo for this morning's Bible reading, because he set the scene quite wonderfully for what I want to say. Because this morning, as you know, he was talking about service. And what I want to talk about this afternoon is really leadership as a service in the context of the NHS. There's a desperate need for good leadership in the NHS. I'm sure many of you, if not all of you, could give examples of poor leadership and how that has led to morale being low, how it has led to patient care not being as good as it might otherwise have been. And I'm sure all of you would agree that there really is a need, a desperate need for really good leadership. Now, in terms of the title of the talk, you'll notice that I've put some brackets around the word Christian that didn't appear in your brochures. And that's deliberate on my part, because what I'm talking about is not specifically Christian leadership. What I really am talking about is leadership. And I don't want to draw a distinction between what's Christian leadership and what's leadership. I don't want to draw that distinction. I want to say that the NHS needs great leadership at this time, strong leadership at this time, Christ-like leadership. And if the people who are providing that leadership are Christians, well then, fantastic. That's a fantastic Christian witness. So let's start with a topic that I'm sure is really important to you in your job, and that's the finance question. Can I take a little poll just to start? How many of you feel that your service, your practice, whatever it may be, is well resourced financially at the moment? Not too bad. Okay, oh, we're getting more hands than I thought. I would say, if I put hands up again, about a quarter maybe. That's actually more than I was expecting. This is a graph of the NHS funding over the last 60 years. And you'll notice that I don't know which way to focus. I've got a little pointer, but I sort of can't. So I'm probably going to point at this one, if that's okay. Or you want me to point at that one? So if you just look at this graph of NHS funding, and you see the fantastic increase that we've enjoyed, really. Because between the sort of 70s and 80s, the orange line looks at absolute funding. The blue line is the percentage of GDP. But looking at the absolute funding. Between the 70s and 80s and into the 90s, we were typically spending every year somewhere in the region around about 30, 40 billion. This is at 2010-11 prices, spending around 30, 40 billion a year. And then when we hit the noughties, as they're called, we see this huge jump up in what we were spending on the NHS, up from 60-ish billion, way up very quickly, up to over £100 billion. And that was attributed to our friend Gordon Brown, who, if you remember back to 2002, brought in this period of really significant increase in spending in the NHS. However, could we afford it? And we're now in a position a number of years later where we look at the spending review of 2010, which, oh dear, okay. Need to be careful with my buttons. We're looking at 0.8
4% increases as being the more typical increases that we're going to see over the next few years. And so this is the sort of environment that we're in, where we have enjoyed a significant period of increased spending, but it's finished. And we were told that maybe a year ago or 2 years ago. And most of you are saying, or some of you are saying, that it's okay-ish. Not too many people. It's going to continue. And Malcolm Grant has just been appointed as the chair of the National Commissioning Board. And this is a headline from just last week. Expect years of fundamental changes and austerity in the NHS. Managers in the last number of years have been very good at making efficiencies in their budgets, but the squeeze is going to continue. And I think most people really who are serious about looking at these things feel that we're going to go into a period of really difficult financial times. Why? Well, we know that really we couldn't afford it. We were going into debt. And the debt that the UK has is absolutely staggering. Whenever you look at the big numbers, they mean very little to us. You know, what's an extra one or two noughts on the end of a number that already has lots of noughts on it? But whenever we bring it down to a figure per person in employment, and we say that over £35,000 is owed per person in employment, not including the money that we give to all the banks, then that really makes a very sobering thought. The UK average wage is £26,000. So we owe a lot more than, as a nation, we owe a lot more than we earn in a year. And that's not including personal debt either. So we are in a difficult financial environment. I don't want to spend too long on that, but setting the scene financially. So what are we going to do about it? Well, we've got our leader, Sir David Nicholson, who we know of in terms of the Nicholson Challenge. I'm sure you've heard of the $20 billion that we're going to see over the next 3 to 4 years that will help us face the realities of the financial squeeze. But I want just to talk a little bit about sustainability. How many of you heard that the 28th of March was NHS Sustainability Day? Did anybody come across that in your work? I didn't, but apparently it was. The 28th of March was NHS Sustainability Day. And the NHS was looking at ways of saving money. However, they did focus really just on environmental saving, turning out light bulbs, whenever you're not using a room or using a little bit, turning the heating dial down a little bit. They looked at sort of the so-called green issues. It didn't get into issues of clinical sustainability. So sustainability in the NHS is an absolutely critical issue. Why are we under so much pressure? Well, we can give lots of reasons for that. The aging population is probably one that we would immediately state. We have a hugely increasing population of people living into 80s, 90s, and into beyond 100. And they are producing pressures. This article is from 2005, but it just puts some clear figures on things. So taking, for example, coronary heart disease, that this is a prediction from the agency Dr. Foster's, who are predicting, for example, that coronary heart disease cases would increase by 44% with a third of an increase in admissions consequent to that. How are hospitals going to cope with that in years and years and years of austerity? Obesity and diabetes is a time bomb, we're told. And looking again at some figures, the NHS is now spending 8% of its entire medicines bill treating diabetes. Again, an article from this week suggesting that by 2035, diabetes will cost the NHS $16 billion, 17% of its entire budget. So the pressures, the financial pressures that we're going to be under in the next number of years are really quite profound. I want you to notice something, however, from this slide as well, that experts say much of this is preventable with health checks and better education, something the Department of Health says it's tackling. And there's a number of slides that I'm going to show to you that just I get the sense of a degree of optimism that the Department of Health is trying to portray in the value and the potential delivery of public health changes. And I want to just point out the degree of optimism that they have. However, we're going to reform the NHS, aren't we? We've had this white paper. We've had a bill which is about liberating the NHS. And let's read some of the words that they used back a year or two ago. The NHS will release up to $20 billion of efficiency savings by 2014. The government will reduce NHS management costs by more than 45% over the next 4 years. We will radically delay and simplify the number of NHS bodies and radically reduce the Department of Health's own NHS functions. So this plan to reform the NHS, to slim it down, to make it more frontline focused, was presented to us as a way in which the NHS was going to be more efficient, more sustainable. However, we have the position now of a year and a bit later, or coming up in 2 years later, of being able to look back and say, what a mess. This is the new world that we're facing. To quote a very senior figure in the NHS, I have lost the plot. When you look at a diagram like this, you lose the point. Between local government, citizens' panels, Health Education England, CQC, PCT clusters, what a confusing picture we're facing. I genuinely believe that Andrew Lansley felt that simplifications could be made and that bringing clinicians into the around the table to talk about really significant burdens of illness that their practices were facing was a very valid one, but he didn't present a coherent reason for the change that he was bringing in. And then he got the wrath of everyone who didn't like the way that he was describing the changes. He said to NHS managers, you're not doing a very good job, we're going to get rid of you. And did they take that lying down? No, of course not. They said, you want to give power to GPs over our dead bodies. And they fought back. And we're in a situation where really very few people can understand entirely everything that was going on. But in the midst of conflict, changes were made and we're left with a situation where most people agree that it's more complicated than we set out. So if this is going to be a way of tackling the debt and distress of the NHS, how many of you would say we've found the answer? Nobody? Then we have the issue of compassion. I'm setting aside the financial stuff. Compassion, and we have seen many, many headlines about compassion in the NHS and how, for example, nurses are accused of lacking compassion. I want to say a little bit about Kieran Sweeney. Kieran Sweeney was honorary professor of general practice at Peninsula College of Medicine and Dentistry in the West Country. He was a GP. But most importantly, he was diagnosed with a malignant mesothelioma at the age of 57, and he died at home with his family on Christmas Eve 2009. Shortly before he died, Kieran was filmed talking about his experiences during his final illness. And I'm going to show a four-minute video clip just now, if our technology allows us. A four-minute video clip where Kieran Sweeney is describing the environment that he found himself in as a patient. I'm not showing you the whole clip. If you Google Kieran Sweeney, you'll find it very easily. You can watch the whole clip. And the bit before that, before I show you, he describes the process of his diagnosis in hospital. And we're starting the clip at a point where he says, when I was discharged.
Any clear understanding of what was happening to me, and came home to the kitchen in my house where I opened the discharge summary, and the discharge summary included the phrase likely malignant mesothelioma, patient aware of diagnosis. So that's how I learned that I had a mesothelioma, reading it at the kitchen table. I think it's important to say at this stage that although that wasn't the right way to learn about it, I think everyone was trying to do the right thing. And the first I learned directly that I might have a mesothelioma was from the specialist cancer nurse who came in to show my wife how to drain the pleural catheter, which is in my right chest. And he, again, acting very conscientiously, said to me and my wife, if I wanted any information about mesothelioma, he'd lots of it available. But there was a point where everyone in the team, including my wife, knew that I had a mesothelioma and I didn't. And that can't be right. I think there may have been something in the fact that being a doctor, I'm being roughly the same age as these guys. I'm in my late 50s. Most of the consultants were in their late 50s or 50s, you know, and our kids would be the same age. This is completely cut and just diagnosis. So you can see them thinking, God, this guy's out of it. And they weren't brave enough. They weren't brave enough to say, this is really bad news for you. Maybe that they hid behind the science of their biopsy and pathology to avoid confronting the metaphysics of my predicament. I am a man devoid of hope. And I just sensed that they hesitated at that point. And my own view is, sounds quite hard, is I just don't think that's good enough. Medicine is not solely a technical activity and pursuit. Medicine is about understanding and being with people at the edge of the human predicament. Caring for somebody is a transactional activity where they do things to me. Everything that I've had done to me in our local hospital has been excellent. There has been a single mistake, I'm seen it on time. For things transactionally, I think the place is outstanding. It's the relational care where I felt that the experience has been less than satisfactory. And it's been a mixture of some really shockingly bad interactions and some shockingly good interactions, some surprisingly good interactions. But I want to stress that when I perceive people to be interacting poorly with me, I still think they're trying to do their best. I still think they don't think that they're actually upsetting me in a particular way. But they are. And my insight into experience is it doesn't take much to change from upsetting or insensitive communication to communication that puts someone much more at their ease.
That's a fantastic clip, and I really would encourage everyone to watch it. The full clip is about 10 minutes long. But Kieran Sweeney, who I never had the privilege of meeting, is incredibly open in it about himself as a person. And he shares stories as the clip goes on of how he was trivialized, to use his word, how he was humiliated in some of his dealings with health professionals, how he was frightened. I'm sure we've all had a chance to be a patient on the other side of healthcare. I've had 3 kidney stones. And even waiting for results of a CT scan, you know, you can't help think, you know, what could this be? Could this be even worse news? You know, is it a little stone or is it something else? Why can't they find the stone? Could it be something more serious? Patients are frightened, and Kieran Sweeney talks about that fear again and again. But I just love the quote that he quoted to us, and I'm going to repeat it a couple of times. Medicine is not solely a technical activity and pursuit. Medicine is about understanding and being with people at the edge of the human predicament. I'm not going to apologize for reading it again. Medicine is not solely a technical activity and pursuit. Medicine is about understanding and being with people at the edge of the human predicament. He believed that health professionals sometimes need to be reminded to discover the humanity in a patient. And I've started this lecture talking about the financial burden that we're in. I've talked a little bit, and I couldn't cope with any more, about the reform process as examples of distress that the NHS is facing. But I want to suggest that this is a greater example, display of distress in the NHS. I almost called the senior sister of the ward that I was on in the hospital with my renal stone over to me once. I almost said to her, and I didn't have the courage to do this, I said, you've come onto the ward at 7:30 in the evening. Sorry, in the morning. 7:30 in the morning. You've spoke to your nurses. You've walked round and you've looked at the end of each of our beds. You haven't said hello. Now, I don't want to pick on nurses. I'm sure doctors make such glaring omissions as well. But what I want to really talk about in this lecture is about connection with patients. The NHS is in debt. The NHS is in distress. Will we get out of it by reform? If it was done better, maybe. Will we get out of it by finding more money? Well, there isn't more to find. What I want to suggest is that we're going to get out of the debt and distress by rediscovering humanity. What do you notice in this picture? I heard it, eye contact. The emotional connection you notice. What are we in danger of replacing that with? Pathways, don't we love them? Everything has to be written down and described in terms of patient pathways. Now, I have a lot of time for describing how patients go through a system and how they can be their journey can be improved. But I just want to highlight the danger I think there is that transactionalizing everything can just diminish that emotional connection. How do we respond to this distress? Well, we can say, right, here we are. We're the people to respond. We're going to change the world. We're going to make a big difference. However, then we read this sort of stuff. Study from East Anglia. Almost half of GPs are emotionally exhausted. 46% fitted the criteria for emotional exhaustion. Our workforce is stressed. Something needs to change. It's not as simple as us saying, right, here we are, let's be the people of change. Let's take on even more work than we had before. I think we genuinely need to stop and look carefully at the situation and just ask ourselves, what is the best way to deal with the debt and distress that we face? I want to tell you a little bit about my story in the last 10 years. I was a GP in a rural town, Llangollen, North Wales. I hope you can see the hills in the background, beautiful place. However, I was asked if I would consider taking on a management job for Wrexham. And so I became medical director of Wrexham Local Health Board. And then the opportunity, as many of you know, many of you who know me know, came up for me to get involved in a social enterprise in the Manchester area. And in a 9-month period, a number of us set up 4 brand new general practices. This is one just before the conversions were made. It was in a shopping center, opening a walk-in center in a busy shopping center in Middleton. And I enjoyed most of the time what I was doing. Working 60, 70, 80 hours a week. But it wasn't good for me. And I then had the opportunity to get involved in a leadership course. And I really thank God for this now, that I had the chance to step back from that frantic activity and look at the NHS more reflectively. And for me, the key issue that really impacted me was asking the question, what really is leadership? And to look at the me in leadership. Leadership is about questions and challenges coming to us. And it's about us making a leadership response. But the bit that's often left out is the bit about me. And through that course, I began to have a look at me. And that this was in 2010, 2011. And began to think really about myself. And then I went through quite a difficult time last year with my father becoming more unwell, with renal failure and passing away. And that really was an extra incentive and influence to me to really look at myself and say, really, you know, you're not living pretty healthily yourself. And I looked at myself after my father passed away and thought, you're overweight. And decided to do something about that. And a famous poem came to me. Some of you will know what this poem is. Anyone want to shout out? Yep, Stevie Smith. Brilliant. Not waving but drowning. And I recognized myself in this, that I wasn't, you know, enjoying all the frantic activity of being an activist in the NHS. Let me just read this. Nobody heard him, the dead man, but still he lay moaning. I was much further out than you thought and not waving but drowning. Poor chap, he always loved larking, and now he's dead. It must have been too cold for him. His heart gave way, they said. Oh, no, 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 it was too cold always. Still the dead one lay moaning. I was much too far out all my life and not waving but drowning. I was much too far out. And I think that's what I realized, that it's so easy as a leader to go too far out, to push yourself too far. Thinking of the statistics from East Anglia, GPs who push themselves too far, it's so easy to do. And that's not the response I want to generate today in this talk. The last thing I want is to be saying the NHS is in debt and distress, let's work harder. Absolutely not. I do not want to be saying that. I'm not saying that. Let me tell you another story. On his deathbed, an old Hasidic rabbi said, "When I was young, I set out to change the world. When I grew older, I perceived that this was too ambitious. So I set out to change my state," obviously American. "This too, I realized as I grew older, was too ambitious. So I set out to change my town. When I realized I could not even do this, I tried to change my family. Now as an old man, I know that I should have started by changing myself. If I had started with myself, maybe then I would have succeeded in changing my family, the town, or even the state, and who knows, maybe even the world." For me, and it's just a personal story that I'm happy to share, for me, I was too to the right, focusing my leadership, my Christian leadership, on doing, forgetting a lot of the time that God's interested more in who we are. And so my prescription for the NHS and debt and distress is really to say, let's pause and let's take stock of ourselves. Of course, the NHS does need attention. And I just want to examine three areas that I think we can, as Christians, respond to. First of all, considering what health is, as opposed to healthcare. Secondly, to look at some issues of funding. And thirdly, what I'm calling the H factor. You'll have to wait to find out what the H stands for. Just a few examples for each of these three areas that I want to suggest that we can, as Christians and as Christian leaders, pay attention to and perhaps bring some change into. Let's start with the first one, health versus healthcare. And I want to ask us the question, are we more interested in what we can do to patients than in the health they have and the health that they can improve? Richard Smith, the former editor of the BMJ, tweeted about his blog, a blog published in the BMJ last week, "Are doctors interested in health promotion?" And he gave evidence from a cardiology conference where he suggests the cardiologists are not particularly interested in preventing cardiovascular disease because they didn't attend the sessions. They flocked to the sessions on stents, but the sessions on health promotion and cardiovascular disease prevention, handful of cardiologists at. So read Richard Smith's blog on the conference that he attended. Are we more interested in what we can do to patients, or are we more interested in their health? Well, let's look at the NHS and see what the NHS is interested in. I'm sure some of you know where this is. New hospital in Birmingham. That's what the NHS does. It runs hospitals. And it gives us lots of pills. And that's the blog I mentioned. Richard Smith, doctors are not interested in health or prevention. So if you look at the NHS, what's the NHS giving its priority? Well, it's clearly giving its priority to interventions. It's not believing the simple message that prevention is better than cure. What is health? Well, if we get past the WHO's really quite strange definition of it being complete wellness, you can find what I think is a better definition of health coming from the 1986 Ottawa Charter for Health Promotion. Health is a resource for everyday life, not the objective of living. Health is a positive concept emphasizing social and personal resources as well as physical capacities. I think that's a much more exciting definition of what health is. If we believed that, what would it mean for us? What would we challenge? What would we pursue in healthcare, in our practice? Well, I think one of the things we would pursue is that we would be pushing self-care. Agree? Are we focused on patients in terms of their innate, God-given resources that they have to improve their health, to eat well, to exercise, to live well, to look after themselves emotionally, to not work 70, 80, 90 hours a week? Are we interested in that aspect of our patients? Remember the optimism of the Department of Health that I mentioned at the start? Optimism that public health measures will reduce the burden of illness that's coming our way in the next decades. Not a lot has been done on self-care. You can find examples of effectiveness, but there's not a huge number around. There's a lot more work to be done. This is some outcomes from the Expert Patients Program showing some reductions in some reductions in GP consultations, outpatient visits, A&E attendances, and physiotherapy, 7, 10, 16, 9% from the Expert Patient Program that many of you will have heard about. Just in the HSJ, the Health Service Journal, this week, there's a practice publishing a study that shows that 77% of participants in a self-care program benefited from a reduction in their blood pressure after 6 months. Self-care, what might it achieve? Well, here's the wastage, or some of the wastage, of the NHS in medicines. We're great at giving it out. If we really pushed and promoted self-care, we may get patients to take more responsibility for their medication, save us money. Bariatric surgery, dramatic differences by making people eat less. Well, are there ways to get people to eat less other than bariatric surgery? Possibly. And what about the emotional health? Are we going to continue to give growing percentages of the population SSRIs? Are we going to really begin to look at the whole issue of emotional distress in society and emotional distress at an individual level? Opportunities for Christian leadership. Financial capital is a term that we are familiar with. Financial capital is our assets, our bank balance. Social capital are the connections we have. I know Peter Saunders, so that gives me a degree of social capital. I'm sure he knows David Cameron, so I'm just two people away from David Cameron. I want to suggest a concept of health capital. Now, I'm not the first to use this term. If you Google it, a few people have used it in the past. But I want to suggest that health capital could be used as a term that describes the resources, the ability, the assets that we have to live well. And that we should, as doctors, as healthcare professionals, oh my computer's playing up. Trying to increase that. So health capital in terms of our emotional well-being, physical, relational, and spiritual well-being. Secondly, funding priorities. So firstly, we looked at the whole issue of health versus healthcare. Secondly, the funding priorities that we have to make. And I hesitate, but go ahead putting the word rationing on this, because we have a finite budget, don't we? We have to be honest about that. Politicians won't be, but I think somebody has to be. That we have to be honest that there's a finite budget and we can't afford all the new treatments. We can't. So where should we put our priorities? I think this is a really significant area for Christian leadership. And for people getting involved in commissioning, this is going to be both a challenge, but I believe also an enormous responsibility as we guide the NHS into how it spends its money. Is the NHS equitable? People living in poorer areas not only die sooner, but spend more of their lives with disability, an average total difference of 17 years. Deprived individuals and families use the health service less than their levels of need would indicate that they should. Our NHS is not very equitable, and that was one of the drivers that led a number of us, as I mentioned, in Manchester to establish new GP practices in deprived areas to try to do something about the balance of provision to people in deprived areas. So as Christian leaders, we could take that challenge on. What should be more important, the latest technology? This may be a very simple x-ray machine, I don't really know. But It looks pretty advanced. So is our priority to buy the latest technology, or is our priority people in distress? Now, I guess if I took a poll and said, how many of you are Christian leaders? I guess, I'm not going to do it, but I guess we might not get everyone's hand up. But I want to suggest that everyone here has an influence. Perhaps it's down to, in our hospital, in our health community, decisions about whether to invest in the latest technology or in some of the deprived people and addicts, alcoholics, the mentally unwell, are people who need more help. How do we bring change? Well, if we're Andrew Lansley, we can reform the whole NHS. I guess there's not too many of us in the room who would be suggesting that as an answer to the debt and distress issue at the moment. Let's have another reform. What I want to suggest is that if we as Christians do something and it's good, it will be recognized, and what's recognized does get repeated. Evidence from leadership, from management of companies, does suggest that positive behaviors, if they are recognized, they will be repeated. And so if we can create a culture in our organizations, no matter how small our particular organization, our GP practice, our hospital department, if we can create good cultures that pay attention to the needs of society, the biggest needs in society, then I pray that those will be recognized and repeated in the NHS. Back to this issue of sustainability. It isn't easy being green. I mentioned the example of the 28th of March, the NHS Sustainability Day. and how, you know, by switching off lights and turning the heating down a little bit, the NHS was going to save lots of money. Actually, it's clinicians who spend the money in the NHS. The prescriptions, the booking people in for surgery. And I believe that we need to examine the decisions we make in the light of the financial constraints and ask ourselves seriously, is this treatment, this medication, this investigation, is it in the best interest of the patients, or is it because we like to be in the forefront? And I really believe that if we do that, we may find that there are clinical areas of sustainability that we can discover. 10%. It's a number a little bit out of the air, but as I have looked at issues of GP prescribing and GP referrals, I don't find it that it would be very difficult for clinicians to make 10% reductions. Because I do believe we can find areas where the money's not being well spent. You know, perhaps we're pushing people into operations where the harm benefit goes against that decision. You know, are we pushing people into treatment, expensive treatments, when the benefit is not clearly there? These are the sorts of difficult decisions, and I'd be happy to debate it, but I think we have to take a growing level of responsibility for how we spend the money. Finally, of the three, I've talked about health as opposed to healthcare. I've talked about funding priorities. Finally, the H factor, which is really the human factor. This is back to the Kieran Sweeney stuff. That emotional connection with patients, that person-to-person relationship. It's not
rocket science.
That phrase really annoys me. Really annoys me. It's said to me as, oh, it's simple. You know, it's so simple. You know, the NHS debt and distress, it's so simple, it's not rocket science, just stop spending money. And I have got now a habit of saying, actually, it's an awful lot more complex. Because rocket science is complicated. It's not complex. What do I mean? Well, I'm dabbling in the world of complexity theory, but in a rocket, everything is known. If you put oil through that pump, or an electric current through that current, you can work out what's going to happen because it's the laws of science, the laws of physics, which we understand. So rocket science is just complicated. It's not complex. This is complexity theory, which I love dabbling with a little bit. Agreement, high agreement, low agreement. High certainty, low certainty. If something is agreed on and is certain, we can say it's simple. However, with technology, things are not always certain, and certainly we don't always agree with you know, the different views of science. But it's known. It can be worked out. It's just complicated. When you get into the world of human interactions, you're into the world of complexity. And we're dealing with a very, very complex environment. And I want to point out a couple of books that Kieran Sweeney wrote that I really would recommend. One is Complexity in Primary Care, and the other one is about the human effect in medicine. That we can't simplify healthcare down to simple rules. It's a very, very complex world. It's a spiritual world. Kieran Sweeney didn't use the word spiritual in his talk. He talked about metaphysics. But I believe as Christians, we need to be saying strongly that we can't reduce medicine down to technical transactional processes, that we have to make that emotional connection with patients. And I just love that phrase that Kieran Sweeney used. Medicine is not solely a technical activity and pursuit. It's about being, it's about understanding and being with people at the edge of the human predicament. It's a very complex world. And it's a world where we've got to understand the spiritual dimensions as well as the physical, social, and psychological. An avalanche. What I believe is that we need an avalanche of compassion, not an avalanche of technically improved processes, but an avalanche of compassion in the NHS. So these are areas of practice that I believe that Christian leaders can be more active in. And I just, before I finish, want to ask CMF a question. And I want to ask the question, has CMF got its balance right in terms of its priorities? And I guess I've had a privilege of standing here today giving this lecture, and I may not get another chance to do it, so I guess I've got to say my bit. But I just want to ask the question, if we look at the activities that CMF's engaged with, have we got the balance right? Are we, as an organization, as a network, as a movement, putting enough focus on compassion and creating that avalanche? Are we putting, as a movement, enough focus on how the NHS responds to deprivation and poverty? Are we giving Christian doctors support in making those really difficult funding decisions? Are we encouraging all of our members to be more considerate in terms of how they spend the NHS's money? Maybe not to be going always after the technical stuff. I don't want in any way to be saying that CMF does too much on the ethical side, the standing against the defense of our Christian principles. I'm not saying that. Please don't take it that way. I'm just saying, on the other side, areas where I believe that we really can make significant advances, we're going to have to step out with new ventures, with new social enterprises, new organizations, new initiatives. We're going to have to step out, and I'm asking, is CMF ready to support its members in doing that? In a little while, there's a very important event happening in Dublin. Ulster is playing Edinburgh in the semi-final of the Heineken Cup. And to me, I just wanted to put a comment about rugby into the talk. But to me, rugby is a great example of defense and attack. When you don't have the ball, you defend. When you do have the ball, you attack. And I just want to say to us all, yes, we have to defend against secularism, humanism. But there are so many areas where we can be on the attack with this avalanche of compassion. But it's not about doing as I say. It has to be doing as we do. And for me, I've needed to have a time to step back and focus and take some me time. And the books that I've found particularly helpful have been written by a chap called Peter Saccazzaro, a pastor from New York, who makes two really important points, I believe, and I just want to share them with you. And he's talking about the church. He's not talking about the NHS. He's talking about the church. He says that the church is lacking in its transformation because of two factors. Number one, it's lacking emotional health. Church members are not strong enough emotionally. And secondly, that the church lacks a focus on contemplative spirituality. And I share this, again, part of my personal story, but I hope it may encourage us all in thinking that it's not about activism. It's not just about getting out and doing things. It's about starting with the me. It's about what I do and setting us as role models as Christian leaders. So just to conclude, I've tried to suggest a number of areas that we can, as Christians, respond. In the area of self-care, in looking at issues of deprivation in society, in emotional well-being, in sustainability in the NHS, looking at the human factor in healthcare, that connection that we have with our patients. I've talked about an avalanche of compassion, and I've talked as well about me care. Because if we can't be healthy, then we're probably not the best people to be trying to bring transformation into the lives of others as we treat them and in our organizations that we work with. Thank you.